Welcome to an open house meeting with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California, on May 15th, 2013.
Hello, everybody. This is John. Good to be here. Good to see you guys here. I'm going to begin with a short reply to a kind of practical question that was in the Anon Talk forum. I assume that you know that in the period following the success at the looking at you, in the period following that, there can be considerable difficulties, complications, confusion, anxiety, things that previously have been held at bay, emotional feelings and that nature, sometimes come roaring back into one's consciousness. And the truth is that whether you do anything about it or don't do anything about it, the end will always be the same anyway, which is that you will end up at home, sane, self-reliant, and safe in your own life. One of the ways, however, that one of the things that we've seen in the time that this work has become more, has evolved more of a community of people actually doing the looking and experiencing the results of it and talking to one another about the craziness that can sometime ensue after having done the looking, we've learned a lot about how to handle that period and what it really consists in and so forth. And what we've come to see is that once the looking succeeds, by which I mean, and what I mean by success is not necessarily any experiential success, but once the looking has succeeded, which means that you have actually made a real attempt to get a taste of what it feels like to be yourself, not yourself with a capital S, but yourself that you know as me. Once that's accomplished, once that effort is taken, what seems to occur is that the sense of a distance between the circumstances and events of your own life and you, the sense that you are able to hold yourself apart from the way in which life unfolds, its craziness, its complications and all of that, that delusion that you're able to hold yourself apart from that evaporates. And we find ourselves, for most of us, for the very first time, directly, without any buffers or protection, directly experiencing the wildness of being human with the still existing personality, the still existing psychological structure, still crazy. So that, I'm not going to go into that in a lot of depth, but that explains why there is pretty reliably a period of considerable confusion and distress following the act of the looking itself. And as we've begun to understand why that occurs and how it occurs, we have also begun to understand more practical and useful ways of relating to what's happening that not only will make the period in which the reorganization of the psychology is going on, it'll make that period less disturbing and less painful, but it also will equip you with the means to be able to be effective in the actual relationship with the unfolding of life itself. And what we've seen in all of that, I'm just summarizing this, what we've seen in all of that is that there is only one thing, really, that we can reliably depend upon to have any control over whatsoever in the way life and my understanding of life and my psychology and everything unfolds. And that one thing that we can do, the one thing we have some control over, is where we put our attention. And of course, that control itself is confused and disturbed and misdirected by the uproar that's going on within the psychology as it reorganizes itself. So what we've learned is that if we can, right then, at the very beginning of the unfolding of the results of losing the fear of life, right there at the beginning, if we can begin to just try to recognize, to notice when there is present some kind of neurotic distress over some feeling that's present, some neurotic distress, by which I mean that calls it anger or hurt or whatever it chooses to call it, this feeling that's there, and identifies it as something that shouldn't be there, and tries our best to turn our attention away from it or to get rid of it in one way or another. What we've found is that if we try to put our attention to use the power we have to move our attention, if we will try to do that in this way, by using it to do what it does best. And what that is what I've been advising people, and what seems to be effective in working, is that once you notice that, you just notice that you're in some madness of pain and misery and hopelessness and despair, whatever form it takes. Once you notice that that's happening, and you won't always notice it, because, you know, we're accustomed to being swallowed up by these things. But when you do notice that that's happening, right there, when you notice it, it is really possible to take your attention and do this. First of all, move it to the feeling that all of the commentary of the psychology is talking about. Like, the commentary of the psychology might be saying, oh, you're worthless, and you're this, and you're that, and you're the other thing, and that's what this feels like, and that's what this feeling means, and so forth. Well, that's just the commentary of the psychology. So instead of just kind of curling up in a ball and trying to wait the storm out, what actually can be done is to take your attention and see if you cannot just get the direct experience of the feeling state that all of the commentary and distress is referring to. What it might call worthlessness or despair or despondency or anxiety or anything it might call it. Instead of attending to the thoughts about the feeling state, look at the feeling state itself, just for a second. It doesn't have to be long. You're not trying to identify it. You're not trying to do anything with it at all. You're really not even trying to make it go away. It's just an intelligent and insane move of attention from commentary about what you're feeling to the actuality of what you're feeling, and then from there move your attention to something ordinary and reliable and uncomplicated, like your breath. Moving your attention to the breath, and you can do that in any way you want. You can count your breath, you can just rest in the rise and fall of your breath. But by putting your attention there, you're putting your attention at something that is actual, and that is not threatening, and that is reliable, and doesn't have any stuff around it. And what we found is that when people begin to do that at the very beginning, they get more and more skillful at using, at recognizing the opportunities to use the what control we have over attention, recognizing the opportunities to use that limited control we have over attention to actually do something useful. So that as time unfolds and the storms that follow the looking go away after a while, the length of time probably would be a lot less if we started out doing what I'm suggesting. So that when that storm passes, as it always does, we find ourselves actually with a new skill and a new understanding of that skill and some practice in using that skill to actually have some effect on the way things occur. It's really quite surprising and almost magical, actually. I hate to say that, but it is. It's only almost magical because I don't understand exactly how it works. But I know myself that if I put my attention on something in which there is some complication or some misunderstanding, if I simply rest my attention on that problem, that things clear up, and my understanding of things clears up, and any residual resistance to these things goes away. So, all that long introduction to set the context for this little message that was posted in a non-talk. What do you mean to look at the feeling state? Do you mean any present feeling of joy, sorrow, anxiety, motivation, or depression? Or is it more a deeper underlying attitude toward life? What I mean is exactly what I just said. It is any present feeling, as you put it, of joy, sorrow, anxiety, motivation, or depression, remembering, keeping in mind, that the recognition of the feeling state as joy, sorrow, anxiety, motivation, or depression, and the definition of that by one of those or other names, it's not to be depended upon. The fact that our initial take is that what we're feeling is anxiety or sorrow or motivation does not mean that that's the actual feel that is present there. Not in order to find out what it is, but just in order to, instead of shrinking from it and trying to stay away from it, that I advise you to actually move your attention to the actual feeling state that all the ruckus and disturbance is about. I mean nothing whatsoever about finding a deeper underlying attitude toward life. The underlying attitude toward life is really very simple. There seem to me to be only two parts of that, and one is an attitude toward life that is conditioned and contaminated by a context that holds that life itself is untrustworthy, dangerous, and not worth the price of admission. That's one possibility. That's the default possibility for those of us who were born and contracted this context of fear of life itself. The other possible way of other possible underlying attitude toward life is an attitude that is has no way of defining life. There's no way to put life in some box that then I know what life is, because life is the wild, complicated, unfolding. I say wild, but sometimes wild means really boring and uninteresting times. The attitude toward life is the absence of any preset idea about how life should be, and an absolute loss of any capacity to entertain the fiction that I can hold myself at arm's length from life. So that, and that's the natural, the normal the actual natural state of human existence, of human experience, is the it's just the direct experience, the direct engagement with, the direct involvement with, with life, which is you. Your life is you. That's really, in this world, your life is you. And there's no barrier or burden or wall between you and your life. And that's the way life feels when the fear of life goes. It doesn't feel like anything except what's actually happening in this moment. So there is no attitude toward, or no underlying comprehensive attitude toward life present, except maybe wonder. So that's for the non-talk thing. I hope maybe somebody here had some value out of that. So here's the way it works, as Carla said. That's all I have to say this morning on my own hook. But I'm here to listen to you and talk together about the things that are happening with you in your life. Okay? Don?
What about, all right, let's take just random emotion like anxiety. What about the situation as with me? It's much, much better than it ever was, but many of these feelings I've had my whole life, they really haven't, as you said, gone unnoticed or been held in abeyance. They've made themselves radically clear ever since I was a kid. Do the same rules apply? It's, in other words, as a result of having done the looking quite a while ago, I don't know. All the negative emotions have decreased, but it's not something that I was sitting on my whole life. It's something that has been up front on an emotional level my entire life. Your suggestion still works, though. I think what you said might have been incomplete in the sense that you're suggesting that people who have not had emotional eruptions before may have it after the looking. I can't say. I had it before. I had it after. But less so now. Just a note, if I'm making myself clear.
Yeah, well, you know, we hear people who report that. That's the reason that I bring that up, and I see no reason to doubt that or not take that into account. My opinion about it is beside the point. That's the only reason I say that.
Okay. Okay. No. Fair enough. Take care. Good to talk to you again, John.
Good to talk to you, John. Okay, anybody else? Saba?
Hi, John.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm very well. You?
I'm not sure how to sort of word the question. I guess just to simply put it, I struggle to actually remember to do the looking, and I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean I'm not doing it right? Or does that mean I just have to keep trying to remember? I find that it's something that I have to constantly try to remember. And yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes sense. It's unnecessary. It can't hurt you, but it's unnecessary. I have always advise that in the first instance, the first time that you try to do the looking, that you try with all your heart to do it in the way that I ask you to, which is to look for the actual very, very faint sensation, experience, feel that is undeniably you. And that's a very faint sensation. Sometimes some people don't even know that they actually did succeed because they didn't consciously have that experience, but what we've learned is that especially in that first time, that it doesn't matter whether you think you succeeded or not. What the only critical thing in the whole act is to try to do it, and to try to do exactly what it is I'm asking you to try to do, which is to get the feel of you, not of self or awareness or consciousness or any such thing at all, but the feel of what you would call me, your me. Now, once that first attempt is made, I am convinced that that itself is enough. And what I've told people in the past, and what I continue to tell people, is that after that, just do it whenever it occurs to you to do so. And I mean that quite literally. If you're walking along the street or living your life, and it never occurs to you to go back to that act, then you don't have to worry about it. The work has been done. You will see the effects of it begin to unfold, both the difficulties and the eventual landing place, and whether you ever do it again. You see, the critical matter here is not to continuously try to get the taste of you, although that's okay, it can't hurt you, but you're really not very interesting. And the only usefulness of the act of looking, it has nothing whatsoever to do, for example, with showing you your true nature or anything of the kind. The act of looking is a mechanical movement of attention that because of its target, invalidates and destroys the context that holds that life itself is the problem here. Now, whenever it occurs to you to do so means just that, whenever it occurs to you to do so. Some people will set up practices where they will do it, you know, like with a discipline over a period of time, with some preparation and approaching it in that way. Other people, like me, and of course at the time I didn't know what was going on, but other people do what I suggest, which is, they will find that as they're, I don't know, walking down the street or driving in a car or at the supermarket or watching TV or whatever, they will find that just an idea occurs to see if you can't get a taste of yourself. And they do so, and then that moves on until the next time that that impulse arises. Now, it may be, of course, that your continuing efforts to do it are ways in which that doing whatever it occurs to you to do so are playing out in the way your life unfolds. The bottom line is this. Really, once you've done the act, it's perfectly okay for you never to do it again. It's perfectly okay for you to do it only when it actually occurs to you to do so, and to do it with lightheartedness and not any serious, like some serious duty that you're performing. I suspect that if you approach it as you have been, as a serious duty that you must find a way of performing, I suspect that that's not going to hurt anything. It's not going to help anything. But what I would suggest to you in this regard is that when that feeling arises that you really need to try to do this, that instead of trying to do the looking, that you, and you know, and when the feeling arises that you have to do so, there's commentary going on about it in your mind. There's thoughts about it and opinions about it going on in your mind. And when you are paying attention to those thoughts and feelings, the feelings of frustration and I'm not doing it right, or I am doing it right, or should I be doing it a different way, when those thoughts and feelings are holding your attention, you just have the opportunity to do what you would do in any case when difficulties arise once you have done the act itself. And that is, decline to attend to the thoughts about this desperate need to continue doing the looking. Don't invalidate it, just decline to attend to it, and move your attention to the feeling that the feeling of what you might call frustration or whatever. But just without naming it, move your attention to the feeling that all that commentary is about, just for a second. You don't have to identify it, just touch it. And then move your attention back to your breath. That's what I would suggest. Because one thing I'm pretty sure of, and that is that having a conflicted sense of a duty to continue this and having to judge whether you're doing it right or whether it's right for you to not do it and all of that, I'm pretty much convinced that that's not going to do you any good at all. It may even prolong the recovery. But, you know, if it occurs to you naturally, look, it's not hard. It's you're here all the time. Make any sense there?
Yep, no, that's really helpful. Thanks, John. You mentioned that some people actually make a practice of it and basically they do it in a routine. Does that help anything, or is that just
some
one of those things?
That practical what?
You said that they actually make a practice of the looking?
Oh, yeah, some people do. I don't think that hurts at all. Here's the thing, right? When we first rid ourselves of the context of fear that has been the cause of all the problems which include the idea that I have to continue some practice in order to make it work right, okay? Once the fear departs, all of those habits, traits, behaviors, and so forth still persist for quite a period of time until they are replaced by new, more healthy psychological structure. And included in that, especially with people who come to us from a spiritual practice, included in that is a long-standing habit of approaching something as a practice which should be treated with respect and enacted, according to some schedule and so forth. I don't think that hurts. In fact, it might even, I have nothing to say about that. I don't think it matters one way or the other. What's not present in the people, and there are not many of them, I have to say, this isn't like a big segment of the population of people who've done this. What is not present, I suspect, in their disciplined practice of it, is that struggle to have to remember to look. And that's what hurts. You know, so if you are trying to do something, if you're trying to look more than once, and you feel that you're not succeeding, and that bothers you, then I tell you, stop trying. If it's natural for you to embark upon a disciplined and un-neurotic practice of something, then that practice certainly isn't going to do you any harm. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps, John. That helps a lot.
I don't recommend it. I just don't think it would do much harm.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's really, really helpful, John. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, good enough.
Thank you.
Stay in touch.
Yes, I will. Thanks, John.
Okay, bye. Anybody else? Christopher.
If I could just change tack just for a moment, John, and ask how you're doing on the financial side of things.
Well, not real well. We are kind of, so far as I can tell, we probably have enough money to get through the rest of this month without too much trouble. But, the whole thing about the financial situation is that, for like 14 years now, we have been doing this work, and during almost all of that time, at least until 2010, the 2010 retreat, it was our feeling that we were enormously blessed with the generosity of the people that we spoke to and spent time with over all of that time. And we actually were, we felt that that to try to raise money, particularly to do anything about what we were doing in those years, would be false and would be asking people to support something that wasn't ripe, and that really what was the development of it was entirely dependent on their generosity and their willingness not only to keep us afloat over that time, but their willingness to spend time with us and talk to us and help us work with the incredible difficulty there is in trying to find a way to speak. And it's bizarre to find a way to speak simply and as a matter of fact about something so simple and matter of fact as what had happened in our own lives. And during that time, the difficulty of trying to speak that and my consciousness of the fact, our consciousness of the fact, that what we were actually accomplishing was very little other than training ourselves and educating ourselves in the constant company of people who were willing to work with us about that. So that during most of those years, we really didn't even want to call attention to try to get people to donate, or like we wouldn't even put up donate buttons on the website or anything. I was of the opinion that we should not require anybody to make a transactional decision in order to hear what it was we had to say and participate in the ongoing conversation. So during all that time, we really were working and living on a very frayed shoestring. And for a long time, it seemed unlikely that we would ever find any way to speak of what we had seen and what had happened in our lives effectively enough to be of use to anyone. And then it turned out that since 2010, in a rapidly developing and falling away of the idea that it was difficult, and a development of ways to speak about this thing in a way that cuts through all the intellectual and spiritual understandings and gets to the heart of the matter, so that people actually just try the act. Well, we've learned how to do that now. We know how to speak about it now. And not only do we know how to speak about it now, but we have seen abundant confirmation that what we see is actually the case, and that this simple thing actually does work, and that it really needs to get out to the entire human community as quickly as possible. And it's because of that that we have increased the things we do, and which has also, you know, taken on some more financial obligations that we are unable to meet without the help. But we now see that now things have changed, so that now we want people to understand the financial aspect of this work, by which I mean that nothing gets done without money. We want people to understand the financial aspect of this work, and we want people to understand that we are barely getting by and being able to do the few things that we do with money that with the income we have now. And we are looking into ways to make it every 3 months, desperately try to find a way to pay the bills that accumulated over that 3 month period. In the past, we didn't mind that so much, again, because we didn't feel any importance an importance to what we were doing at all. But now we do see that this is important, and this is something that should be brought to the world. And I know that we have no money, Carl and I have no money, and no trust funds, no nothing. So that the only, just as with the development of the uncovering and development of this amazingly powerful little thing. Just as with that, the development with that, we have to depend upon the community that has been a part of this from the very beginning to see for themselves, first of all, the importance of bringing this to the world, and once seeing that, the importance of providing financial support for it. You know, we have an extremely generous community here, but it is quite limited. You know, it's a couple thousand people, and it's not a bottomless pool of available money. Most of the people, maybe all of the people who are involved in this work, are not folks who have a lot of spare money to get to anything, no matter how important it is, so that when we ask for money because of financial emergencies like we did at the end of last year, a couple months ago, people responded with great generosity. But then when we come to this time, I think that what's happened, the amount of money that people have available has already been diminished by what we took from them before. So that one thing we've come to see very clearly, I hope I'm not getting too detailed about this, but one thing we've come to see about this is that we have to find a way to find financial support for this that doesn't impoverish the people in the community. And I'm not sure what that means, but we're open to all kinds of suggestions. I hope that's helpful. Does that make any sense to you, Christopher?
Oh, I appreciate very, very much your sharing, John, because I do feel concerned. As you know, I find that this approach of priceless value in my life. Just one or two thoughts spring up, and if I could just offer in total respect and love, and also realizing that they may not have any validity at all. But like, for example, you were mentioning that you've been expanding the scope of the work, so that the message can reach a larger number of people, and it's a wonderful urge to respond to. I suppose, for example, the grassroots program might be an example of that. The word that comes up for me is the word sustainable. People talk about sustainable farming, and it makes a lot of sense to me. Anyway, as I say, whether this is a valid thought or not, you've given that idea of expansion a try. But I think what I want to say is that supposing you were to cut back a bit in some of these further outreaches, cut back a bit to a more leaner operation. If the fundamental message that you proclaim really is a value, and it really is a value, no question. Maybe in a certain sense, it doesn't matter whether the external scope of things is increasing, at least at this point, because the validity of the message, nothing is going to diminish, dilute that. So, just I suppose as a possibility, trim your sails a bit to a place where it is more sustainable, and trust that the irrefutable truth that is being offered here, it'll find its own way to attract the larger interest.
Well, I this is a longer conversation than we're going to have time for here, but what brings to mind is, what pops into my mind is the old saying that God helps them that helps themselves. But that's just me. But here's the thing, Christopher. What would be useful maybe for you to say about this is that we are not, the amount of money that it takes for us to do what we're doing has not increased by that much. What has increased is the amount of time that we put into it. And the amount of money will increase. But right now, you see, Christopher, right now, right, we're not doing anything. We have not spent money any more than we have in the past by, for example, creating the grassroots movement and the forums and all of that. That all that stuff's been there. The mechanisms, the practical means have been present for a long time. It's not increasing our expenditures to do what we've done so far. But here's what I think. And the truth is that we simply don't take in enough money in donations month to month to pay for what we already are doing. We don't take enough money. We haven't taken enough money in donations to pay for what we are already doing for the last 4 or 5 years. So, it's not like we're in some extravagant expansion of expenditure. We are trying to expand our reach, and eventually that'll take more money than even enough to keep doing what we're doing now. But we already don't have enough money to do anything that we're doing now, which is why over the past 4 or 5 years, every 3 to 6 months we have to call on people because we're in financial straits. And we've already cut back everything that can possibly be cut back. So that there's two parts to this. One part is the sustainability of what we are already doing, which is already and always has been unsustainable in the terms of reliable income, like in monthly pledges and the general donations from time to time over the month, single donations that people make. We've never been sustainable, never, not for a long time, even to keep this going, what we're doing already. So that needs to be addressed. The effect of that mostly is that you can't imagine how much of my time is spent juggling and trying to figure out how to get this paid and how to get that paid and so forth and so on. Well, if we could just get to the point where our current state of operation was paid, then that would free up a great deal of money. A great deal of time that we could put to better use. But the other thing is, and I really would like to have that happen. That's the first goal, is to get us to the point where we are sustainable because we have enough income to pay for what we are already doing. And we're not doing any different now than we were before. We've cut back everything we can cut back. And that really is important, as anybody can see. And we're not sure how to go about that, but we're working on it. We're talking with people and so forth. But the other thing is this, Christopher. I'm a little bit reluctant, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think, here's what I think, and I think, and Carlin, I think, this is what we see to be the case about the human situation, the situation of humanity in this time. We have seen over, and I am something of a student of history, and a kind of a, you know, a it's kind of a hobby of mine. And forever, human beings have been going through a cycles of insanity, of the different ways in which insanity manifests. And those cycles go through periods that eventually always end up over a period of time, reiteration of the same stupid mistakes that we always make, that always end up with some huge, debilitating and destructive catastrophe that that everything pretty much starts over from the beginning. But these run in cycles, and you can see them. You can see, if you look back at everything, you see, you know, that there's periods when everything is going along more or less well, and then things get bad, and then things get worse, and then the internal warfare that is driven by the fear within the human community itself, and the persistence of the insanity of human activity and human relationship to one another and to life, they get to a point where they boil over, and then everything gets kind of back and starts all over again. And I know that. I know that that's the case, has been the case all along. And what I've seen, however, also, is that those cycles are accelerating. And they're accelerating partly because of the fact that there are so many more of us now. You know, I mean, there's what, 7 billion of us scattered across the planet? There's more of us now. And the other thing is because we have become much more effective and much more, much more effective, much more skilled at enacting our insanity, the self-destructive insanity that the fear has placed in all of us, all of us. And we're much more effective at, you know, enacting that insanity. Now, I look around the world now, and although where I'm sitting right now, everything is pretty nice and beautiful and so forth, and my life is beautiful, and I love my life and all of that. But I look around now, and I don't sit in a protected monastery or anything like that. I see what's happening in the world. And I see what's happening in the world is that we have come to a point in which the collective insanity of human self-destructive activity engendered and driven by the fear has gotten to the point where we really are on the edge of creating, of driving ourselves extinct. The level of violence, the level of horror that's in the world is unlike anything it's been before. Probably, maybe mostly because there's more of it, and there's more of it known because we hear more about what's going on in other places. But that all goes into the pot, too, and stirs the fires. I really believe, Christopher, that it's quite possible that we may get to the point very quickly when humans just won't be able to make it through. And that gives me a sense of urgency that is different from the kind of relationship to work of this kind that has gone before. It gives me a sense of urgency because I no longer see that the main thing here is for individuals to find freedom in their own lives, although individuals must find freedom in their own lives in order for humanity to survive. But the main thing is not the possibility of individual human beings coming upon this and seeing it and finally and getting free of the fear. And I have to tell you that one of the most common results of freedom from the fear is a withdrawal from human community, a withdrawal, going away somewhere where you can live your life and enjoy it, and that's perfectly understandable. From my point of view, we have got to get this simple thing out to the world. And what I mean by get it out to the world is not to bring to the world a huge new theory of everything or a huge new metaphysical understanding of the nature of being or anything of that. What we have to get out to the world is the simplest possible message that is imaginable, which is to get the idea, just the idea, of looking at yourself everywhere throughout the human community. And that's not the kind of thing that requires centuries of development. And it's not the kind of thing that requires billions of dollars in order to accomplish. And it's not the kind of thing that requires inaction and withdrawal from the actual state of humanity, because we really are all in this together. And I, myself, I really love human beings. I really think that the appearance of human beings on this planet was a worthwhile thing to have occurred. That the nature of human consciousness and the nature of human, the possibility of human relationship with existence on its own is worth saving. It's worth saving humanity. It really is. And the thing about what I'm saying is that to do what I want to do, again, first of all, I want to be able to pay the bills to do what we are doing, you know, but to do what I want to do, which is to get that simple idea out into the entire human community, that's not something that's going to cost millions of dollars. It really isn't. It's not. With the instrumentality that we have available to us today, is something that can happen very quickly. Some have seen it already happening. I had somebody here who, somebody the other day who said something about the memes afoot, because having seen the fact that without any direct reference to us or our work, there are these things appearing about looking at yourself or other things of that nature. So the meme's afoot, but what we want to do is get that meme big and healthy, and so that the suggestion, the idea, just the idea of the possibility of looking at yourself gets to every human being that is possible to reach as quickly as it's possible to reach them now. And because that's all it takes. If people hear it, they do it. When they do it, the outcome is always the same. You know, the process is different, but the outcome is always the same. So I hope that answers some of your questions about that, does it?
Oh yes, very much, John. Thank you for your words.
Yeah, it's just so little, you know, and it's not. Like, we're not trying to create an institution. We're not trying to create, like, a new teaching. We're not trying to create a doctrine. We're just trying to get this simple little act, the idea of this simple little act, into the ears of everybody. Okay?
Yep. Thanks, John.
It's different. It's all right. Thank you, Christopher. I really am grateful for the opportunity for us to talk about this together. And I'm just very grateful for that. This is something that's new to us and probably new to this kind of activity as well. Okay, I'm going to go now. Take care of yourselves. I'm very, very happy to be here with you. We have a worldwide, by the way, we have a worldwide open meeting on the 16th, I think, in which I intend to talk something. I intend to talk to the question, is the looking spiritual? And I think that I'm going to try to put that question to bed at the next Worldwide meeting. So, in the meantime, I love you all. I'm incredibly grateful for your unbelievable presence here. Stick around. Carla has some things to say. I'll see you the next time.
You just listened to an open house meeting with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California, on May 15th, 2013. For more live recordings, visit our podcast at www.justonelook.org.